Good morning and welcome to Davos. My name is Jim Frederick, and I'm the international editor at Time Magazine. And it is my great pleasure to welcome you to one of the kickoff sessions of the 2012 World Economic Forum in Davos. As you all know, Davos is a forum where some of the world's most distinguished minds come together to discuss the world's biggest, broadest, and most pressing problems. And I think, as this past year has shown, some of the problems we are facing today are more pressing than they have been in a long, long time. As a bit of a departure, and in an attempt to foster a more spirited discourse, the World Economic Forum and Time have framed today's panel as a debate, centered on discussing the premise, is 20th century capitalism failing 21st century society? This morning, I'm honored to be flanked by some of the finest minds who have convened here today to help us get some traction on these issues. In alphabetical order, but not necessarily in seating order, we have Sharon Burrow, General Secretary of the International Trade Union Confederation. We have Brian Moynihan, CEO of Bank of America. We have Raghu Rajan, the Eric G. Gleacher Distinguished Professor of Finance at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago. We have David Rubenstein, co-founder and managing director of the Carlyle Group, and Ben Vervaan, CEO of Alcatel-Lucent. And my thanks to all of you for joining us. So some specifics about how we're going to run this morning. In keeping with the spirit of an Oxford-style debate, I'm going to begin soon with a vote that I will throw out to the audience about whether they agree, disagree, or are undecided about the resolution that 20th century capitalism is failing 21st century society. And then, because I don't really think that a five-part, that Oxford-style debates are not really designed to be answered in turn by five people, and I think it would get quite tiresome if we went all the way down the line, do you think this is true, do you think this is true, I'm going to break the session up into smaller, more generalized mini-postulates to see if our panelists will be willing to take positions for or against. After a couple of rounds of that, we'll have some more info to see where our panelists stand. I might have some follow-up questions, and then with anywhere between 20 to 25 minutes to go, I can open the panel up to questions from the audience. And finally, with only about, you know, 2-3 minutes to go, we'll close the session with another round of voting to see if anybody in the audience has changed their position on whether or not they think in Oxford-style debate style that they think that 20th century capitalism has failed 21st century society. So that's a lot of material to get through. Thanks again for being here. And just as a reminder, because we do have so much to talk about, if both panelists and audience members alike could be complete yet succinct in both their questions and answers, even probably more succinct than I've just been. So in order to begin, I'm going to offer the resolution. 20th century capitalism is failing 21st century society. From the audience, could I please see a show of hands, those who agree with the resolution? All right, I'm going to say that's about 40 to 50%. How many disagree with the resolution? That's probably 20%.
We have a roll call vote.
What?
We have a roll call vote?
No. Well, we could, yeah. Unfortunately, this is a room without the little voting machines. And because it is an option, how many are undecided? Ooh, at least it's a resolute group.
So it's 30%.
Okay. Actually, I'm curious from the panel, if I could just throw this out, how many of you are in favor of the proposition that 20th century capitalism is failing 21st century society? We have one vote. One against four. Okay. So we know where Sharon will stand. She will be the confrontationalist.
I think I'm outnumbered. There's something slightly unfair about this. Come forward first.
Assume it's not a gender-related issue either.
Okay. So as promised, because I don't think it necessarily makes sense to have them answer in turn the same question five different times, I'm going to throw out a smaller premise that I hope will get us some information moving towards the larger premise. So here's a concept that's been much discussed in the press, including Time and other places in the aftermath of the economic crisis. And these premises are necessarily vague and generalized, so we can drill down deeper into them as we discuss. But here's a premise. Corporations have too much power. And here I'm not just talking about you know, arguably under-regulated companies in Western liberal democracies, but also, you know, resurging state capitalism systems in China and Russia, Middle East, and elsewhere. Now, Sharon, I am, as probably the designated confrontationalist, I have a feeling that you would agree to this premise.
Absolutely. We believe in a principle called fair go all round. And when you have extremes of power on any side of the equation, then whether it's capitalism or governance or governments, then the balance gets out of whack. And right now we've lost a moral compass. We think you need to redesign to some extent capitalism. We believe, by the way, in sustainable business and secure jobs, so it's not about the system, it's about the model of the system. And when you have the greatest inequity since just before the 30s Depression, this is actually bad news for capitalism, because their prescriptions are actually eating themselves up potentially. If you look at Europe, you've now got the latest predictions of negative growth. And yet we warned that rushing mindlessly to austerity, listening to the obscenity of the marriage between the ratings agencies, three, an oligopoly in the world, too much power if there was ever any example of that, and the bond markets, without sitting down and looking to a growth strategy, would fail both business and workers. So think of some of the statistics. Greatest inequity since before 1930, and the Great Depression, you've actually got 17 of the richest countries in the world who've gone backwards in equitable terms. What's that do to demand? Then you've got 210 million people out of work. So the market's lost its capacity to actually soak up people who need to be employed, to have a job, to create that demand, to generate sustainability. And we have 45 million young people, our children and grandchildren, entering the labour market every year to economies that can't accommodate them. So, you know, I could go on. I mean, there's the greed. We must redesign the model, but we must reset it. Greed, stop the greed. You know, there's, of the high-worth individuals, there's something like $11 trillion plus in offshore assets. That's $250 billion of tax that could be going towards. In fact, it's something like three times the amount of aid provided to the developing world. And if you look at taxation, you know, this is now a national sport everywhere, avoid taxation. We actually need to say, if capitalism's going to sustain itself, it's going to provide secure jobs, it has to distribute wealth evenly, and it has to make a contribution to the common good. And let me say finally, on the power piece, greed, profit above all, you know, unless you actually reinvest in social protection, the social protection floor now endorsed by many of the world's leaders and ourselves, unless you actually invest in minimum wages on which you can live, and unless you reinvest in collective bargaining to distribute the wealth, then frankly, those who want to have greed at all costs, to not work with unions and other civil society groups in terms of the common good, whether it's bargaining with unions or aid and development with others, then you're actually undermining your own future. So absolutely, too much power, and it's time to reset, redesign, let's see some innovation, and let's get a seat at the table for the real economy. Will the real economy stand up? The financial sector's killing you. And unless employers and workers actually sit at the table with governments and redesign the system, then it will continue to fail our societies. It's as simple as that, and nobody will like the social unrest that will follow.
Thank you. Ben, I was going to ask you about this question because we talked about it a little bit in the green room, and you pointed out that this was a very vague concept, you know, power meaning what, corporation meaning what, but framed within her response, she talked a little bit about inequity, she talked a little bit about greed, there was an implied critique of governments and the I would say the late 90s style capitalism, profit motive above all. Would you care to respond to the concept that you know, admittedly vaguely, corporations have too much power?
For the sake of the debate, my answer would be they have not enough power.
Great.
And the question is, not enough power for what? I mean, I understand this is a debate about who's the villain, okay? Who's the culprit? And first of all, maybe the culprit is the philosophy. So the culprit is capitalism. Well, if you travel the world, you'll find places where the aspiration is to go to capitalism, because it has lifted millions and hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. So maybe it's not the philosophy itself, it's the way we execute it. And then people say, oh, well, okay, if that's the case, maybe it's the corporations. Well, I heard the discussion. It was interesting to talk about securing jobs. Securing jobs is the problem. If you're in a job, you get the unions to secure where you are. But if I'm not in a job, how about creating jobs? Creating jobs is something completely different from a philosophical point of view than securing jobs. I think we have to have a real discussion. At the end of the day, we are living in a world that is shifting. Power is shifting from west to east. Reality is shifting from a physical world to a digital world. People are 24/7 involved. The young people have a very different set of criteria than the people that are in power today. So we need to talk about innovation, sustainability, I mean real sustainable. And we need to talk about reform, not just about corporations and greed. I mean, it's too easy. It's about decision making. Why does it take Europe 2 years to come to a conclusion that they knew that they had to face in any way? The only way that happened is bad news became worse because we waited 2 years to do the inevitable. Unless we are going to take the hard questions seriously, to be honest, this is a great let-off of frustration, but it doesn't solve anything.
Can I just ask one follow-up question? I mean, that was a fantastic answer, and it provides a lot of fodder for the rest of our discussion. But you introduced it saying that the corporations don't have enough power. What would you like your corporation or other corporations to do that you feel that they're unable to do?
So I took 3 points. The first point that I took was, let's see what we can do in innovation. Innovation means creating. If you look to legislation and regulation, you know, I'm a green believer. So if we want to do what we really need to do, we bump into conflicting priorities from all kind of regulators, the EU, the American government, and all kind of others. In one side, they say this is what we want, but the rest of the world, their own world, isn't there yet. So there are all kind of conflicts there. That's why I say not enough power. We need to choose.
Got it. Okay. There's a lot of great information here, and we will get back to a lot of it. I'm going to move on to another premise, and I like the way that Ben framed it, because let's be frank. You know, he said really a lot of what this panel about is who is the villain, who is to blame, and frankly, banks have received a lot of the blame for a lot of the problems that the economic system has suffered over the past several years. So I have a premise here that large banks can cause harm to the social good because they enjoy a disproportionately favorable risk-to-reward ratio, or I guess it would be reward-to-risk ratio. This is the too-big-to-fail syndrome. Then there seems to be an ongoing social bitterness and resentment that being too big to fail is both a real and vicious cycle. Now, Professor Rajan, I'm going to ask you whether or not you agree with this premise, because if I'm not mistaken, you have written about this quite extensively, including in the most recent issue of Time. So would you take a for position on this, that to a certain degree, banks do have an overly favorable reward to risk ratio?
I think the answer is yes for large banks, but let me come to that in 1 second, because okay. I want to address the previous debate a little bit. I mean, this issue of inequality and whether, you know, warped corporate governance is the cause of this inequality, I think that was the premise that we first heard. And I would argue that there are deeper forces which are driving the inequality, and unless we tackle those deeper forces, we have no chance of rectifying it. So I think 3 big forces, the fact that technology has required greater and greater skills. Second, the fact that we have a global market now, and therefore the competition for talent is global, and talent is more important because it has a global arena in which it plays. And third, that clearly over time, the rewards to innovation, the need for innovation is also increasing. Again, the demand for skills. So technology, competition, globalization, need for innovation, all these are pushing for higher pay at higher levels of skills. Now, this is not to say that this explains what is happening at the top 0.1%, but clearly when you look at the top 90th percentile, why that's running away from the 50th percentile, it's ultimately because of these forces. These are not going to be affected by corporate governance. Doctors and lawyers today are earning much more than they used to. A lot of the people in the top 1% are not necessarily just corporate executives. They're lawyers, they're doctors, they're professionals. The returns to skills have increased.
But the minimum wage in America is $7.20. That's lower in real terms than in 1969. How can those people buy your product?
That is a different question. The question is whether the skills are being rewarded justly or whether this is a complete failure of corporate governance. I don't think it's a failure of corporate governance by and large. Not to say there aren't egregious instances where corporations overpay their executives. Those are problematic. But I don't think by and large you can explain the rise in wages of the upper levels of the population simply by bad corporate governance. Now to the question that you asked me a minute on that. Clearly, large banks have had an advantage. They are too big to fail. They are too complicated to fail. That is not to say immediately that the answer is to break them down. You may replace too big to fail by too many to fail. And we have seen instances, certainly during the Great Depression in the United States, the big question was, why do we have so many small banks? Because they're failing like flies. We need to find ways to revive them. We got deposit insurance then. So the immediate answer is not shut down the large banks and create a lot of smaller banks. It is to A, make the larger banks better managed, and second, have the larger banks carry better buffers, and third, make the larger banks more failable, so to speak, more easy to fail so they don't enjoy this premium, which I think is a travesty of capitalism. When any entity sort of survives, regardless of how bad it does, when there's no chance of it being destroyed, it prevents entry, it prevents competition, and that ultimately is the cause of the demise of capitalism.
Okay. Now, Brian, I think that you might be interested in taking the opposite side of whether or not banks enjoy a disproportionate reward to risk ratio.
I think you have to go back, and it's embedded in all this, is what the role we play as an institution. So we play a role where we transmit in society basically what goes on. We reflect economies of whatever country a bank is in, by and large. And so when capital markets are going strong, you'll see capital markets activity heat up. When consumers are borrowing, you'll see that heat up. And so we do that for everybody here. I mean, we literally, clients of like Alcatel, or clients like the university he works for, and clients like unions. In our relationships with the unions around the world, we do things like credit cards where they receive revenue from that stream to help promote and provide what they can do. So we reflect the economy. So the quote power that we have, or the size that we have, comes from the size of the economies. And so that's a reality. Now, against that is we also reflect the excesses. And so what you saw is that the economic excesses build up, the financial service system in the United States and around the world reflected that. And so the amount of leverage, the amount that the consumer's taking on, transmitting that, we've done a lot to pull that out. And the regulations and rules that the societies have developed around the world have changed that, whether it's the Basel III on the one hand, whether it's Dodd-Frank. And I think that there's been a lot done on that. And that's the kind of corrective course of capitalism. You have a boom and bust. But I think the idea that we enjoy some sort of special thing. We also pay a lot of special things, so the FDIC insurance in the United States is paid for by the system, and the cost of that is largely in smaller bank failures today, but that's the reality of what goes on, and we're fine with that. So I think if you think about it, our power, size, capabilities come from our clients, the 285,000 people we employ, what we do to transmit that in society. Every piece of revenue is a representative of economic activity taking place. The amount of things that went on that would have considered to be excessive and off to the side have largely been constrained. And most of the people running institutions that survived and took over the institutions that largely were outside the regulatory scheme and failed have brought that into a more sober-minded, more direct thing. And the third thing is we are also going to reflect the pluses and minuses of capitalism. So when there are excesses, you'll have boom and bust cycles. Real estate related in the late 80s in the United States, foreign debt related, Latin American debt related, and emerging debt related in another decade. But the job is to continue to learn from that, correct it, and try to keep it. And there's times when innovation stuff gets ahead of it, makes it harder to do, and that's what we're going through now.
Sharon, you're shaking your head.
Oh, look, I just find this incredible. You know, too big to fail is about socializing your losses, not about sustainability in a genuine sense, not about serving the real economy. And in fact, what it is about being so big that when it works against good governance, works against competition in terms of the price of credit to small to medium enterprise, for goodness sake. I actually agree with Ben. This is a bit scary, really, but much of what he said about sustainability, innovation, small to medium enterprise and the relationships are right. However, if you've got a group, 29, I think the Financial Stability Board says, that are too big to fail, what does it mean? It means that you are the biggest bullies on the planet, because when your governance fails, then in fact you actually demand of governments, because they don't have any choice, to bail you out with whose money? With our money, with taxpayers' money. And who's bearing the sovereign debt costs now? The crisis didn't create, sovereign debt didn't create the crisis. Crisis created sovereign debt. And you know what? We stupidly bought into it. We actually promoted the stimulus packages that the then director of the IMF called for and government heads said would actually help leverage demand. And in some countries it worked because it went to jobs, went to the real economy, the retail sector, the construction. In many countries, it went to bail out the banks. And that's still the debate 3 years on. In fact, the second wave of the crisis, the fact that we've got now a bitter crisis of unemployment, greater impoverishment, is because governments were too coward to move to do what they said they'd do. You remember them saying at the height of 2008-09, never again will the financial sector be in control of the real economy. Well, guess what? Inaction, government inaction is the reason we're now in this situation again.
Well, that segues nicely to my next point. I think that things are going lively enough that we don't necessarily need to hold to the debate premise format. But I do have a question for you, David, then, because you were going to be one of the people that I picked out. Sharon just mentioned, you know, government regulation. And I think, you know, in your role as at the Carlyle Group, you might have a thought about whether or not increased government regulation is possible, desirable, and a solution to the current economic crisis.
But before I address that, I'd like everybody to just think back. I suppose this panel was being held 100 years ago, and the question was in 1912, is 19th century capitalism ready for the 20th century, or going to help the 20th century? And look what happened in the 20th century. We really couldn't have predicted in 1912 what happened throughout the entire 20th century, and nor can we predict now where 21st century capitalism is going to take us, because we're only 12% into the century. But what happened in the 20th century was that you had fights between communism and socialism and capitalism as the prevailing economic model for the world, and more or less capitalism prevailed. Not because capitalism was perfect. Nobody said capitalism was perfect. As Winston Churchill famously said about democracy, it's the worst form of government except every other form. Capitalism may be the worst form of economic systems except every other system. Capitalism prevailed at the end of the 20th century and now into the 21st century because it more or less provided more wealth, more productivity, more jobs for people than anything else the man could come up with. However, it has its imperfections, and those imperfections are seen best when you have the current environment we have. We've been in a very deep recession, the Great Recession. When you look at something in the trough of any kind of economic period of time, it's going to look very bad. So as a result of this recession, which has lasted much longer than anybody predicted, and will probably go on for a number more years, in effect, we really never got out of the Great Recession, in my view, we're going to have a lot of economic disparity. The two greatest problems that capitalism has produced, and capitalism still will produce for many years into the 21st century, is it doesn't have the ability to modulate risk and reward and growth and lack of growth. And so you have these boom and bust periods of time. For a while in the latter part of the 20th century, we thought we were so smart that we eliminated the economic cycle. We haven't really done that. So we still have to deal with the economic problems of boom and bust, and we're seeing the problems of the bust right now still affecting many of the people that you're worried about. Many of these people are really hurting, and this is one of the problems that capitalism produces. Secondly, we have the problem that disparity, economic disparity, is very, very bad in many parts of the world, and capitalism has not solved that problem. Capitalism has many great virtues, and many people are wealthier than they ever were before, but we haven't solved the economic disparity problem. The question is, how do we deal with it? How do we eliminate the economic boom and bust cycle in capitalism, and how do we eliminate the economic disparity? Obviously, nobody in this panel has this answer, and nobody in the world seems to have this answer. The question is, how can we work through this problem? And my view is that government is supposed to be the leader. We elect people to be our leaders because they are the ones who are supposedly the ones who have the ideas and want to lead us. And I think what we'd like much more in the business community is leadership from the government officials that we elect. In the West, we have seen a lot of inability to provide leadership during this recession, and I think that is one of the problems that has created the continued economic disparity and the continued growth of the or the lack of our ability to get out of this recession. I wish we had more economic leadership. In terms of regulation, everybody thinks they're overregulated. I've never met anybody who says, please regulate me more. I need more regulation. I need your help. Nobody ever says that. Nobody ever says, tax me more. I want more taxes, with the possible exception of Warren Buffett. Nobody ever says, tax me more. And nobody ever says, regulate me more. So I don't think that I want to be more regulated. My concern is that whenever there is an economic problem in the United States, we had Enron, we had the recession. What we do afterwards, at least in the United States, is we regulate and we pass legislation. We pass Dodd-Frank's, which is 2,300 pages, the regulations for which have not been issued. The Volcker Rule, with the most famous part, perhaps, of the Dodd-Frank's, hasn't had any regulations that are finalized like yet. The business community doesn't really know what the rules are that we're supposed to live by. So, yes, we don't mind regulations in the business world. We think regulations are appropriate, but tell us what they are in a reasonable period of time in a simple way so that we can actually operate under what the government wants us to do. Right now, many people